From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, reflecting on the life and legacy of George H.W. Bush, 41st President of the United States.
This is my mission, and I will complete it.
Also today, a former substitute teacher on why he thinks today's students need more discipline.
In the schools that I visited, there were no consequences for behavior that was what we call errant behavior, out of control behavior, which was very different from the way I grew up.
And New England cookbook author Dory Greenspan on the delights of everyday cooking.
It doesn't take any more effort to make something delicious and surprising and kind of munchable. Like you take one spoonful and you want to take another.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. We start today with the passing of George H.W. Bush, the 41st President of the United States. Bush passed away late Friday night at the age of 94. Here he is accepting the nomination for president at the 1988 Republican National Convention.
I fought for my country. I've served. I've built. And I'll go from the hills to the hollows, from the cities to the suburbs, to the loneliest town on the quietest street, to take our message of hope and growth for every American, to every American. I will keep America moving forward, always forward, for a better America, for an endless, enduring dream and 1,000 points of light. This is my mission, and I will complete it.
Bush's body will be arriving at the U.S. Capitol shortly, where he will lie in state in the rotunda until Wednesday morning. A memorial service is scheduled for Wednesday at 11 a.m. For more now on the life and legacy of President George H.W. Bush, we turn to David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. David, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And also with us is Boston College history professor Heather Cox Richardson, author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's always a pleasure.
Heather, we're going to bring you in just a minute, but I want to start with you, David. You wrote Bush's obituary for the Boston Globe, and you described him as a gifted foreign policy leader. Do you think that's his most lasting legacy in terms of his time as president?
Well, I would have thought so when he left office, that was probably his greatest asset. But I think his greatest legacy now is as a sentinel of a certain kind of civility and grace that is not present in our politics now, and that his death is a reminder of what we've lost. So, you know, there are plenty of public policy people and foreign policy people around. There aren't a lot of people with that inner grace. We know, of course, from Massachusetts that some of that grace was set aside in the 1988 campaign to beat Governor Dukakis. But nonetheless, I think his greatest legacy now is different from what we might have thought it would have been in 1993 when he left the White House.
I want to get back to that point. Heather, I want to jump to you. You know, there has been this outpouring of nostalgia for the more civil, gentle political approach that George H.W. Bush seemed to embody. Do you think that's a fair assessment of his approach?
I think it's fair to say that we are reaching back to that now, sort of in desperation because we feel it's so far from us. But he's important domestically because he marked that bridge between the old Rockefeller Republicanism, Eisenhower Republicanism of his father, Prescott Bush, and the modern-day Republicanism of people like Newt Gingrich right up to the present with Donald Trump. He was really the bridge. If you remember, in 1980, he's the one who looked at Ronald Reagan and the rise of Ronald Reagan from the right and said that his economic policies were voodoo economics, and yet gradually was forced to capitulate to that vision of society to the point that he does embrace the Willie Horton ad, and he does put Dan Quayle, who had well-known connections to movement conservatism and to evangelicism, in the slot of as his vice president. So he really marks that transition. He himself might have been the old genteel Republican from the East, but he represented the shift to what we have in the present.
Mm-hmm. And to talk about that Willie Horton ad, for our listeners who need a reminder, you know, it was a 30-second television commercial in the heat of the campaign showing Willie Horton, this African-American man with an ominous voice, saying that Willie Horton had been let out of a Massachusetts prison and went on to rape a woman. And it was considered a scare story of an African-American criminal. Tell me the impact of that ad and how it changed politics.
Well, to say it changed the situation is an understatement that at the time, in the summer of 1988, Dukakis and Benson were running almost 20 points ahead of Bush and Quayle, and the Willie Horton ad is what changed the debate entirely. It was an absolute race whistle, and it was designed to be that. I mean, the people that were on Bush's campaign were people like Lee Atwater, who quite deliberately were using the issue of race to try and reorganize America by marshaling race along the side of the Republican Party rather than and turning people against the Democrats.
And Roger Ailes, of course, aided with that. So, you know, we have this assessment that here is this genteel, this diplomatic form of politics that George H.W. Bush embodies. But really, is that true? And also true is it that he's also what connects the modern form of Republican politics and, like you said, the Rockefeller form of politics from the past?
Well, I actually think David put this very nicely in his obit, and John Meacham has said the same thing, that Bush was willing to do anything it took to get power to go ahead and govern in what he considered to be the mode of an Eisenhower or Rockefeller Republican. He was just hemmed in by the time he got there. What do you think, David?
Well, I think that's so. That Meacham quote is quite interesting about how John explains how the president would do anything to get the power. He would traduce his own values to get power so as to project his own values. Now that's a morally, at best, ambivalent view. We always think of Clinton as the person who puts things in boxes, but the ultimate box keeper was George H.W., who was able to do that. He was able to do that with Clarence Thomas as well, and to still have that sense of gentility. And I think a lot of that sense of gentility came in the post-presidency. We were accustomed to saying that the best post-presidencies were Hoover's and Clinton's. But the one who did the best with his post-presidency may well have been George H.W. Bush, who erased from the American consciousness the fight about Justice Thomas, who erased the Willie Horton by being a gracious host, by inviting people like me and others constantly to Kennebunkport so we could burnish his image, who exuded a certain grace and elegance, even as we were losing any shards of grace and elegance from our civic life. But I'd like to hear what Heather says about this.
Well, you know, I think that's true, but I also think that the point you made initially is so important because we tend to forget that George H.W. Bush oversaw the end of the Cold War. And that, you know, he succeeded in that in part by doing things quietly and by not triumphing. If you imagine a president since then, his son, for example, George W. Bush or President Trump, at that moment, they would not have kept their mouths shut and let things fall apart and quietly. And it could have been World War III. And even his involvement with the first Iraq War, refusing to permit small countries to be gobbled up by big countries in the wake of that cataclysmic change in world society, solely by doing nothing, in a sense, over big issues, is to me sort of the positive that a president can do by not doing something. But you look at that moment and you think we were very, very lucky to have a man who'd been trained in intelligence and who did have that layer of gentility on him, having the grace to handle it the way he did seems to me to have been almost unique in the era since the rise, if you will, of Richard Nixon.
This is the place where we employ a phrase from another Republican president, Calvin Coolidge, a former governor of Massachusetts, who said, "I never get in trouble for things I don't say."
But even for the things he did say, some of it we have forgotten, like his criticism of the 1964 Civil Rights Act when he was running for Senate in Texas. His abandonment of his longstanding pro-choice politics in order to be chosen as Reagan's running mate. And even during his presidency, you know, his critics said he seemed disconnected from average Americans, that he lacked a true domestic agenda, especially at a time of great economic unrest. But so much of that is not part of the bigger conversation of his legacy. Why do you think so much of that has been overshadowed by this image of an elder statesman that he was able to form, also partially as a result of his humanitarian work under Bill Clinton's presidency?
Well, I think part of it is what came next. And part of it is that you do forget some things. Who talks today about President Nixon's welfare policies or his highway policies? I mean, you do tend to... You know, you do tend to gloss over a lot of things, but it is true that he changed his mind on a lot of things. You know, there should be some room for politicians to take a look at the landscape and to adjust their views. Sometimes it's actually done by conscience. I have no idea on the right to life versus abortion rights thing what motivated the president. I tend to think that it was not necessarily pure, but we don't really know what's in the man's heart.
Do remember that when he is running in 64, that's also when Barry Goldwater is running. So for him to take the positions he did were much more moderate than Goldwater was doing, and he was running better than Goldwater, but he was this movement of the party to the right as it moved south and west, and he's running from Texas and picking that up. I also think when you look at him and his switch to the Right to Life movement from being so firmly pro-choice, it's a mistake to ignore Barbara Bush's effect on his rehabilitation, if you will. Barbara Bush was a woman that many people really, really liked. They liked her outspokenness. They liked her continuing support for women. They liked her support for choice. And that enabled him to kind of burnish up his moderation, his points on the side of the moderates that he couldn't get in his harder stances. And they were a team, and people liked that they were a team, especially in an era when marriages are not necessarily long-lasting or don't necessarily look very good in the public eye. And they really managed to pull that off and support each other. And she helped his image a lot, I think.
So George H.W. Bush, you know, he came to the Republican Party when the party, as we were speaking about earlier, was showing early signs of veering to perhaps zealous and populistic conservatism. Do you think George H.W. Bush, with the Willie Horton ads, with his defense of Clarence Thomas during the Anita Hill hearings, with his switch to pro-life instead of pro-choice and so many other choices, do you think he laid the framework for what is now Donald Trump?
He absolutely paved the way for the rise of the kind of politics that we've seen, not just with Donald Trump, but in the era since him. The Willie Horton ad really legitimized that. If somebody like a Bush, somebody who had been so instrumental in the Eisenhower wing of the party, was willing to kowtow to that part of American life, to that part of American culture, to throw link the whole concept of a government that regulated business and provided a basic social safety net and provided infrastructure, to tar all that as being an attempt to provide special interests for murderers and killers. It signaled that that was the direction that the party was going to move, and it's not just Donald Trump who's done it since then. It has gotten more and more extreme on the part of the Republicans. And you wonder what would have happened always in American history, you know, if George H.W. Bush had come out and refused to hire Lee Atwater, had refused to go down that road, had said, "We are better than this. I will not support this. I will take a loss in the election, and I will support Dukakis and Benson and work really hard to win next time free and fair and square on American values," if we would be where we are today. And I'm one of these people who believes that the ends never justify the means, and I think we have proof of it right there with that despicable, as Michael Dukakis later called it, Willie Horton ad.
I never understood what affinity George H.W. Bush could possibly have had with Lee Atwater, given Lee Atwater's involvement with the Tom Turnips seed campaign and all some of this other kind of stuff. It was a mystery, and I think a moral problem that I don't think he ever reconciled, and that we are ignoring a bit quite a bit in this period of mourning and reflection.
Well, thank you so much to both of you. That's Boston College History Professor Heather Cox Richardson, author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And David Shribman, executive editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, a former substitute teacher on why he thinks discipline can set students free. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. The age-old discussion about how much discipline a child needs is sparked everywhere, from the home to the classroom. And for some educators, there's been an ongoing call for more discipline in schools to help make their job easier. Sin K. Henderson was once one of those educators. During his year as a substitute teacher in dozens of schools in Los Angeles County, he noticed that many students lacked a sound discipline structure. That has him calling for more discipline in schools, which he talks about in his new book, Sit Down and Shut Up: How Discipline Can Set Students Free. Henderson, a graduate of Harvard University, argues that discipline can serve as a gateway to freedom and opportunity for young people, particularly students of color in vulnerable populations. He joins us now from Los Angeles. Hello, Sin K.
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Thanks for joining Radio Boston. So let's start with your basic premise. What are the benefits of having discipline in a school setting?
Well, the importance of having discipline in a school setting is the same as having it at home. The primary issue being that all young people, all students, all kids, they eventually test the boundaries that are around them. They test the adults. They test their parents. They test the strangers. And if when they push against those boundaries, if they find that there is nothing there, then that creates chaos in their minds. It creates chaos in their emotions, and it plays itself out really throughout their life.
So, I'm sorry. So your year as a substitute teacher is what led you to write this book. You talk about your encounters with students who openly cursed at you and in front of other adults, you know, threatened teachers without repercussions. And then you link those actions to problems of structural racism and economic disparities. Talk to me about how you made that connection.
Well, it just happened sort of serendipitously. My first day at a really tough school in Los Angeles, I, as you say, got cursed, threatened, as they say in the South, called everything but a child of God. I sent this kid to the office, and they maybe five, certainly less than 10 minutes later, he came back with a note saying, okay to return the class. No call home, no detention, no suspension, no apology, nothing. I was stunned. When I was coming up, we would never speak to adults the way I have that. We wouldn't even curse in the presence of adults. I'm from a small black town in the South. And later on, that said, I come from a family of educators. Later on that day, I had a sort of a great experience. And so really kind of fell in with enjoying overall the experience of teaching. Now, what led me to sort of make these connections is one day I was at this same school and a teacher had gone there as a student himself, was now teaching at that high school. And he said to me, you know, the school was always tough, but students used to fight each other. Now students fight the teacher. And I have to say that set off an alarm bell in my head. As you say, I went to Harvard. I studied under Henry Louis Gates, Helen Vindler, and I'm enough of an amateur sociologist to know that he had said something very, very, without knowing it, something very alarming. And that was when I knew somewhere in here may be a book, maybe a story that needed to be uncovered. And I knew that a sociological question in making that statement that I wanted to find the answer to why that shift had happened from students aggressing against each other, which is bad enough, to suddenly aggressing against adults.
So we know that these children whom you talk about in your book, they're children from vulnerable populations. They're dealing with big structural issues, which you admit to in your book, educational segregation, mass incarceration, racist policies. And yet you say that discipline is the only proper route to freedom and opportunity for generations of poor youth. You know, that's a bold statement. The only proper route. To help me understand here, how is that not overly simplistic?
Well, I think, look, I think you have to mix both things. So that statement is probably more bold, but it's really a statement in response to what's going on in schools now, which have completely routed discipline. So it's really sort of a statement to say, guys, we need to slow the brakes down on eliminating. We've gotten rid of completely getting rid of suspensions, completely gotten rid of, in many ways, detentions. So let me just give you a little bit more sociological context. So the issue about that I wanted the answer to aggressing against adults, and I was, why did this happen? And this will give you some sense of where I was coming from with a statement like that. And I agree. And let me say for the record, I'm a liberal Democrat. I think that's important for your readers to hear and know. I was driving home one day, and I was listening to Jay-Z on the radio. It came on actually on NPR. And someone asked him, I think it was Terry Gross, asked him, what was the effect of crack cocaine on your coming into your neighborhood? And he said something really startling to me. Startling. It wasn't more violence, more deaths, more jail. He said it destroyed the authority figure. I was stunned. I didn't quite know what he was talking about. So as I listened and then on, I started to research what he was saying. Crack cocaine, which is now, you know, about a generation old, was essentially a child's economy. Because of the mandatory drug sentences that were set down in the Reagan administration, if you were an adult and you were selling crack cocaine, you'd go to jail for upwards of 10 years. So they gave crack cocaine to kids to sell. And because all of the manufacturing jobs had fled the inner city, it was young people who were making the money, and the adults were powerfully addicted to such a devastating drug.
Right. So this is, again, a systemic societal problem. You find the root of this problem. So why not focus on the root of this problem instead of the discipline issue? And I want to, let's talk about the reality of disciplining right now. We know that Black students are suspended and expelled at a rate three times greater than white students. We know that suspensions affect girls of color disproportionately. And we know that on average, 5% of white students are suspended compared to 16% of Black students. This is all from the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights. Black girls are suspended at higher rates, 12% than girls of any other race, and most boys. Boston Public School System is wrestling with this issue right now. It's restructuring its school suspension practices because we know that vulnerable youth have been historically targeted by tough discipline, and that these methods of discipline can have lifelong consequences for vulnerable youth. So given the history, given the research, why up more discipline when we know that it can have great, great consequences, negative consequences for the most vulnerable of children?
Well, I think there's a problem with the way this is being discussed, and the book attempts to go in a very serious way into all of those points. The first thing I would say is that students of color being disproportionately suspended, these are I accept those as facts. There's no question about that. But we also have to understand that students of color come from poor backgrounds. They come from, in large proportion, fatherless homes. And kids who come from those sorts of backgrounds bring emotional and psychological chaos with them into schools. And I want to be very clear, I am 100% for group therapy. I'm 100% for the sort of redemptive types of methods to help draw students back into line. But the problem is we've overcorrected and gone too far in the other direction. I have been in so many schools where there is no ability to say, you know what, you've gone too far. You cursed at the teacher. You got to go home today. And it throws those schools into complete chaos. And so we have to balance both the need for kids to have a safe environment with also with the need for the environment to be safe. And so I think I 100% support impulse control training, which teachers have not had, and kids should be getting from elementary school level, the level from actually kindergarten and before impulse control, that kids can be trained in that. I absolutely support all of the sort of group therapy, individual therapy, and those sorts of things. But you also have to be able to draw a bright line and say, you know what, you've gone too far today. I actually support, you know, reform schools, unfortunately, used to be many jails. I believe in bringing back really strong, but there are some terrific reform schools in this country, some in Pennsylvania. And there need to be schools where kids who have come into schools without the emotional and psychological training that a lot of kids get because their homes are shattered, because their parents are addicted to drugs, that sort of thing.
Okay.
They have to be able to – yes, I'm sorry.
No.
Yeah, they have to be able to control those impulses in order to thrive in life at all.
Got it.
And
so, yeah. Sinke, you also credit the lack of male authority figures, especially
yes.
for young Black men, as part
yeah.
of the discipline problem, like we've been saying. And I want to read a quote from your book. You say, quote, "A crucial, if unconscious, change occurs in the mind of a fatherless son when he realizes he can topple his authority figure, that is, his female parent. He thinks of himself, even if unconsciously, as a man. The only authority figure above him can no longer hurt him." Can you, if you can sort of unpack that statement for me, but also when I read that, I have to say my flags went up for me because I thought, is this pathologizing an entire generation? And is that dangerous?
Well, you know, as again I say, I know it doesn't sound like I'm a liberal Democrat, but I am, and I will say progressives and liberals do not respond to that claim very well. And I'm not saying you're a liberal, I'm just making a point here. And I'll say that we have to be honest about what the consequences of not having a father are. We can't say fatherless, fatherless, fatherlessness, and then pretend that it doesn't have concrete consequences on particularly boys, but girls as well. So let me just unpack that really briefly and say, I was in a middle school. I heard this young boy brag, saying he was scared to see his dad this weekend because his dad punches him in the chest and knocks the wind out of him. Another kid kind of said the same thing, and they had these glum looks on their face. I knew, however, that they were actually bragging. And this is something that I think it's maybe difficult for women to understand, and don't mean to be sexist here, but boys care, young middle school boys care about the physical strength of their dad. It's just the way I cared about it. It's just the way the male at that young age matters. And so later on, I was reading Twitter, and all of these adult men, Black men, they happen to be Black, were telling these hysterical stories about when they tested their dad. You know, they were taller than their dad. They were suddenly 13 and strong. And they tried to kind of say something slick to their dad. And their dad either pulled them up by the size of the collar and said, "Hey, this is my house. Figure it out." So but when a boy, as you read, when the boy shoots up and he's suddenly taller than his mom and he's faster than his mom and he's stronger than his mom, boys that young, all they care about are sex. They care about dominance, and maybe they care about money. And they realize that they're the strongest person in the household.
Sinke, but boys, yeah. Boys are complex. They're not a monolithic group. There's all kinds of boys, and so I just worry that this is generalizing.
Yeah, I agree that we are all complex and we're all individuals, but teenagers and adolescents and preteens also have certain psychological habits that are just innate to that stage in life. And I think we have to be able to have an honest conversation. You know, I know on both sides. I feel like this is an issue that both Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals need to be able to come together about. And I think that one of the things about the book, when you are really up close with kids and you observe them and you're able to see day to day what happens when they don't have dads, when they don't have the sort of healthy-minded discipline, which I advocate very strongly in the book. I want to be very clear. I'm not a law and order conservative. How that actually brings about a sense of psychological safety in their own minds.
Okay. Well, Sinkei, thank you so much for joining us. We could talk so much more. I have so many questions I wish I could tell you, but we've run out of time.
No worries.
Thank you. Sinkei Henderson, writer and former substitute teacher. His new book is Sit Down and Shut Up, How Discipline Can Set Students Free. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
BrainGate. If that name sounds familiar, it's because it's a science fiction-y research project that's been underway mainly here in Boston and at Brown University since the mid-2000s. Researchers are using a tiny brain implant about the size of a baby aspirin to allow severely paralyzed or locked-in patients to move a computer cursor with their minds. Common Health editor Carrie Goldberg is here to tell us about the latest news to emerge from the BrainGate project. Carrie, welcome.
Thank you, Maria. And I'd like to begin with a familiar melody. So you recognize it?
I do. It's the theme from Beethoven's Ninth, right? A lot slower than it's normally played, though, right?
Right, right. And it may definitely not sound like the most rousing rendition you've ever heard, but I personally find it mind-blowing because what we were hearing there is an ALS patient playing the piano with her mind and only with her mind.
So just her mind, not her fingers? How exactly does this work?
So she's looking at a virtual keyboard and she's willing a computer cursor to click on the notes she wants to play. And she's doing that with the help of an array of about 100 tiny electrodes implanted in her motor cortex. That's the part of our brains that controls voluntary movement. So the electrodes are picking up and decoding her brain signals, and they're being translated into action in real time.
So what exactly do you mean by brain signals? Which brain signals?
So, like, if you wiggle your finger right now, you know that your brain gave your finger a command to wiggle, right?
Right, which is not exactly conscious. It's not something that you can really put into words.
Right. If you did, it would be like, finger, wiggle, right? So, yeah. So the BrainGate device picks up that sort of nonverbal command, and it's allowing a person like this woman to play the virtual piano, for instance. And in a new paper in the journal PLOS One, researchers report on three paralyzed patients performing the kind of electronic activities that people without physical disabilities take for granted. You know, e-chat, streaming music, surfing the web, all of which was done in the study with off-the-shelf tablet devices connected wirelessly to the BrainGate device. Here's the paper's senior author, Dr. Lee Hochberg from Brown University and Mass General Hospital.
People who are unable to move their own limbs can simply think about moving their own arm or hand, and we can decode those brain signals in real time, and we can give them a chance to control the same tablet computer that they might have been using before the onset of their disease or injury.
So it's mind-blowing, right? Like, it's wild. The BrainGate research has been underway since 2004. They've been working on the brain science of figuring out how those neural signals work and the engineering side of converting the signals into action, whether of a cursor or even of a robotic hand. So back in 2012, they also blew my mind with a video showing a paralyzed woman using her mind to move a robot arm holding a cup of coffee close enough to her mouth that she could sip it from a straw. Now, that was published in the journal Nature. And a lot of this work uses very specialized devices, but this new paper uses just regular old off-the-shelf tablets connected to what's called a BCI, a brain-computer interface.
As in, your brain is controlling the computer, or at least it's kind of meshing with the computer?
Right, like mind-melding with it. Here's how Dr. Hochberg explains it.
We have our decoded neural signals. We can put them through to emulate a wireless mouse, and our participants were able to use that tablet computer for email, to chat, to check the weather, to launch Pandora and listen to whatever music they wanted to listen to.
And Maria, to play the virtual piano or to chat with each other. And these patients were people who had trouble speaking because they had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, or spinal cord injury.
Carrie, so all of that could be life-changing for people with mobility issues. How many paralyzed people might this BrainGate device be able to help?
Well, so first, it's important to note that this is very early research. It's more like proof of concept. And there have only been 13 people so far in the BrainGate clinical trials who've had these little decoder devices implanted in their brains, and maybe 7 or 8 other people around the country in similar research. But the potential patient population is not small. It's several thousand Americans are diagnosed with ALS every year. Well over 100,000 are living with spinal cord injuries that affect their arms too. Lots of people get strokes, and some of them might be helped as well. Dr. Hochberg works as a neurologist as well as doing research, and he says his hope is to tell patients with things like ALS losing their ability to talk that they'll never lose the ability to communicate.
I may meet somebody who's had a brainstem stroke, who was walking and talking yesterday, and today is unable to move and unable to speak, except for perhaps some eye movement. And I really want to be able to say, again, I'm sorry that this happened, but tomorrow you're going to be able to communicate. And maybe some point in the future to say, but tomorrow you're going to be able to move again.
One thing that they're pushing on now is to make these devices even better, faster, more reliable. And one thing that has gotten a lot faster is calibrating the device to a new patient's brain signals. Dr. Hochberg says that's down to only about 3 minutes or so.
So the device is implanted, and within 3 minutes, a patient could move a cursor on a screen?
That's right. That was a paper last year in the Journal of Neural Engineering. So a patient who'd never used any interface like this before could control a cursor almost right away. And the goal is to get to the point where a patient could use something like this 24/7, maybe with a prosthetic arm, and without the current rack of computers about the size of a mini fridge that they need now.
So if they reach that point, is there any chance something like it could help non-paralyzed people navigate their computer screens more efficiently, or say to play an instrument better and faster?
Well, so I wondered that too. I asked Dr. Hochberg, and he very gently told me that the BrainGate research team is really focused 24/7 on helping people with paralysis. And I would just add, Maria, my personal principle is never to install a device in my brain without a very good reason. Not at this stage, anyway.
I would say that is a very sensible personal principle.
Yes.
Well, Carrie Goldberg is editor of WBUR's Common Health. Thank you, Carrie.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. Do you ever open the fridge and think, what can I pull together from what I've already got to whip up a delicious dinner? Or perhaps you've got that go-to favorite recipe that you've made dozens of times, each time tweaking and changing it just a little bit based on what's in season or what's in the crisper drawer. You're not alone. It's the kind of thing that 5-time James Beard Award-winning author Dory Greenspan took to heart in her latest cookbook, Everyday Dory: The Way I Cook, a collection of simple, beautiful recipes that don't require special skills or new gear to make. Dory Greenspan has written 12 previous cookbooks, including the New York Times bestseller Around My French Table and Baking Chez Moi. She wrote Baking with Julia after spending a summer in Julia Child's kitchen, and writes the On Dessert column for the New York Times Magazine. Dory, welcome back to the show.
So glad to be back. Thank you.
We're so happy to have you. So we had you join us a few years ago for your previous cookbook, Dory's Cookies.
Mm-hmm.
And you've written a number of books that are baking-based. What sets this collection apart?
So this is I call it a cookbook. So it's food as well as desserts. And it's so funny. Somebody said to me when I was talking about my book, she said, I didn't know you cooked. I thought, what do you think I've been feeding my family all of these years? And so this is kind of the answer to what do you think I've been feeding my family for all of these years? They're very simple recipes. They're very practical. And it's my second cookbook, cookbook. So my first was Around My French Table, and that was 8 years ago. And in that time, my husband and I have been spending more time in Westbrook, Connecticut. And so this book, I sometimes think of it as my Stop and Shop or Big Y cookbook. This book really depends on nothing more than a supermarket and the need to cook dinner.
Yeah, so maybe this will be my Trader Joe's and Star Market cookbook.
It's essentially the cookbook for anyone who doesn't have, you know, a gorgeous French open air market on their corner.
Right. So you know, you split your time between living here in New England, in New York City, and also Paris. Mm-hmm. How do these three places influence how you cook and how you bake?
You know, it's such a good question, and you would think I would know the answer, but I'm always thinking about this, and I always come down to I'm pretty much the same cook and baker everywhere. I think I have a very consistent style. What changes is the way I shop and the ingredients I can easily have. So in Paris and in New York, it's easy for me to just walk downstairs and get. I mean, the 7-Eleven has preserved lemons, you know, in Paris. In Connecticut, I'm an hour round trip from a supermarket. And so in Everyday Dory, I'm cooking from supermarket ingredients, my refrigerator door. I shop in my refrigerator door and my pantry. And so the food has, I think it's the same as the food that I make elsewhere. Right. I just have to be a little more creative.
You know, your cooking has become, you say in the book, more easygoing. Your food has become simpler, your style more spontaneous. What led you here to these kinds of meals that you call elbows on the table meals?
I love that expression because when I think of elbows on the table meals, it's we're all sitting around the table. We've got something delicious at the center of the table and we're all scooping it and talking. I think this is part of it comes from living in France part-time where I've come to see what French home cooking is like, the polar opposite of what we see in restaurants. Right. And it's really my own style is very casual. I don't decorate things. I don't have formal dinners. I always have people over for an easygoing evening. And so this is really the kind of food that I think of it as food that gathers people to the table and keeps them there chatting and enjoying.
That's what I found so beautiful about the photographs in this book, is there's something unfinished about the presentation almost in a way. It's like so casual. You have a lot of dishes in like wooden blocks and like just...
Exactly.
Beautiful.
I'm so glad you felt that way because that is the message. So I taught myself to cook. I'm not a trained chef. And when I was learning how to cook, I only wanted to make the most complicated food because I thought that was what fancy food was and I wanted to be fancy and I also wanted to learn. Now, all these years later, I just want things to taste good and I want to make people happy with food.
Okay, so our producer, Jamie Bologna, made some recipes from your cookbook.
It's so fabulous.
I wish our listeners could smell the way the studio smells right now. It's so fragrant. It smells so good. So I want to talk a little bit about what we have here. First, we have a ricotta spoonable. The recipe, by the way, is posted on our website, radioboston.org. Dory, tell us about this recipe and why you like preparing it.
So this is really a typical Everyday Dory recipe. It's ricotta mixed with lemon zest, lemon juice, and a bunch of herbs, whatever herbs you have. And finished with olive oil. And it's the kind of thing that you can put on a cracker or thank you for passing this to me. One sec, I have to stretch. Thanks.
We're passing food in here. Sorry, everybody.
You can have it on a cracker. You can have it on grilled bread. You can put it on top of roasted peppers. I have a recipe I love in the book for oven charred tomato stuffed peppers. It's good on that. Scoop it up with carrots. So I make this, put it in a jar, keep it in the refrigerator. It'll stay for a few days and just nibble it as the days go. It's a great addition to a brunch or a starter. Mm-hmm. Put salad under it.
So we also have your honey mustard salmon rillettes. This recipe is also on our website. What's in this one?
Okay, I'll make this one for you. You were nice enough to make the ricotta for me.
Okay.
So this is a great party dish. It's a combination of quickly poached salmon and smoked salmon. And it has mustard and mayonnaise and... Thank you. Okay, I just got a little help serving.
Yeah, thank you.
And once again, it's like the ricotta spoonable, like so many of the recipes. Make it ahead. It tastes better if you make it ahead. And it's a great dish for the holidays.
Mm. You know, so many of your recipes in this book include surprising ingredients. And that's a word that I kept reading over and over in your book, the word surprise. You have walnuts and oats in your meatballs, for example.
Mm, and they're good.
Yeah, and surprising. Why are surprises so integral to pleasurable meals?
So I think for me, I just love when there's something unexpected because I think it delights my friends and family when they're expecting something that they... when they're expecting something they know, like a meatball, and then they take a bite and they're, this is different.
Like I just did?
Like you just did. My favorite. It's any cook's favorite sound. Yeah. I like when there's something that is delicious, but you can't quite put your finger on it. And so you go back for another bite. And it just increases the enjoyment. And besides, you know, I'm in the kitchen every day, as a lot of people are. And I think... girls got to have fun. Got to play around a little, find those little unexpected touches and surprises.
Right. So speaking of those unexpected touches, we have a Mediterranean shepherd's pie that our wonderful producer, Jamie, made. Recipe from your book as well. This has butternut squash, you know, which is not something that we associate with shepherd's pie.
No, and the spices are different as well. They're very Mediterranean. So this came about, as so many of my recipes do. I had a butternut squash in the house. I had some spinach in the refrigerator, and I was making this pie, which is a combination of, it can be beef, it can be turkey, it can be lamb. You can put some sausage in it. It's got onions and garlic as it would. But it also has za'atar if you have it, or some thyme. It has lemon zest. It's got big flavors in it. And I thought, that butternut squash, it would be pretty in there. It would, because squash kind of takes up flavors, you know, it would take up some of the tomato and the spices, and it would really add something to it. And so I put it in and loved it so much that it became a real recipe.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, just listening to you, you bring such joy to cooking.
I love what I do. I wasn't trained, and I'm all but dissertation for a doctorate in gerontology, the study of aging. And so I made a big change to do this, and I feel so lucky that I got to do it.
Where do you derive your joy for cooking?
You know, it's kind of the whole thing. I love the process. I love transforming ingredients. I'm using my hands. You can't see this, but because I love touching and working with the ingredients. Mm. I love sharing what I've made with people. That's the great pleasure of cooking, is sharing.
Yeah, spoken like an artist. So if you were to offer one word of advice to someone intimidated in the kitchen, what would it be, Dori?
Oh, it has to be two words. It has to be three. It has to be... No. So I would say just get into the kitchen and cook. You know, even mistakes taste good. And take time to enjoy. I said I enjoy the process. I think if you take time to enjoy every step of what you're doing, you'll really come to look forward to cooking.
Dori, thank you so much for joining us.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Dori Greenspan's latest cookbook is Everyday Dori, The Way I Cook. She'll be doing a cooking demo at Northeastern University tomorrow and speaking at the Harvard Bookstore tomorrow night. There's more information about both events and two recipes from the book at our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Maria Garcia. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.